I love you. Did the DNA come through? Yes, I love you.
Oh my!
Oh my! Wow! Wow! Episode, wow! Wow! Wow!
Episode 7. Did you ever think we'd see the day?
Never. And I'm so glad we're here though, because holy wow!
Yeah. You know, John, how do you feel about name dropping? Does it make you uncomfortable?
It does, but not in today's episode.
No. I'm going to embrace celebrity.
Yeah.
We're going to embrace name dropping because, after all, we are fans.
Yeah.
We are fans before we are important Hollywood luminaries.
We are K-level celebrities.
K, yeah, I'm comfortable. I think at my peak, I was a G-level celebrity.
Yeah, fair.
Yeah.
Fair. But we're going to talk about the A-level celebrities because people love gossip, Hollywood gossip.
Yeah, I do. Well, so CSI was on the air for like, I don't know the exact number of seasons. I think
1 million.
1 million seasons.
It was
seasons.
On a long time.
And over the course of time, I think Al Jolson got his start on CSI. Humphrey Bogart did an episode early on.
Wow, really dating ourselves.
Yeah, well, that's not true.
No.
But you know who did?
Who?
Michael Jordan.
What?
Yep, that's right. Michael Jordan. Yeah, not the basketball player, the famous actor.
Michael Creed. B. Jordan.
Michael B. Jordan.
He was on CSI?
He was on CSI.
I didn't know that. Did you work with him?
I did not.
Okay.
Dakota Fanning.
You work with her?
No.
These are good stories, though. Keep listening. Keep going.
Tell you
we're
going to
find one.
I'll tell you who I did work with.
Who's that?
I pulled a rubber chicken out of Peg Bundy's mouth.
Peg Bundy?
Yeah, Katie Sagal. And she was super nice.
She seems like she'd be super nice.
Uh-huh.
All right. Boom. There's one good story.
I had lunch with Wolfgang Puck. He was on an episode.
Did he make the lunch?
No.
He totally he should have. Oh, he should have made the lunch. No, he was
implied.
An actor on the show.
Yeah. I think we didn't make him. Isn't the expression sing for your supper?
Right.
But we didn't make him make supper for his supper.
That's right. You shouldn't S where you eat.
Yeah.
Kind of thing.
But I'll tell you what. I was like very nervous because it's Wolfgang Puck and I love to cook.
Yeah.
And I sat down. He was by himself. At a table, and I sat down next to him. I said, "Is this taken?" And he said, "No, please sit down." And just to make small talk, I'm like, "So, what do you think of Concord grapes?" Because I was growing Concord grapes.
Good.
And he lit up, John. It
really?
Was like the key to a great conversation. And we discussed the miracle of Concord grapes, a delicious grape, by the way.
A miracle.
For like a while. And
that's
he gave
cool.
me a recipe
for
sorbet, for Concord grape sorbet.
And did you make it?
Yeah, it was fantastic.
There you go.
Yeah. Yeah, sorbet a la Puck.
That's actually a really good story. Yeah. That's winning so far.
Yeah. Do you have any fabulous...
Nothing that good.
Oh, wait. Do you remember when the original lineup of Black Sabbath was on?
I do.
Did you meet Ozzy?
I met Ozzy very briefly. I just got to shake his like old withered hand. He was like, no sir. That's what he said to me.
Really?
Yeah. He didn't even give me no recipes for anything.
I had no recipes?
No recipes. He didn't teach me how to be a rock star. No advice.
I had the weirdest interaction with him because, Ozzy Osbourne, Black Sabbath, a big fan. So I went in for a handshake. Like, and then he went in for a hug.
No.
And then when he saw that I had gone in for a handshake.
You did that whole awkward dance?
When he saw it, he changed to a handshake. But I had already shifted into hug mode, right? Because
he poked your chest.
Right. So we kind of awkwardly mashed upper extremity body parts. And it was so weird.
No, that's wonderful.
It was so
great. That's another
great
story. That's a better one.
I mean, the list goes on. We had Roger Daltrey from The Who on. I didn't work with him, but he was very nice.
Yeah.
We had, who else? Oh, Gene Simmons.
Oh, Kiss.
No, Kiss. And Gene Simmons, I don't know if our friends at home know this, but he was born in Israel and he speaks Hebrew. And I speak broken Hebrew.
Yeah.
So we had a conversation about potato pancakes in Hebrew.
A recipe, perhaps?
It wasn't a recipe, but we did talk about potato pancakes. I'm most comfortable talking about food and baseball in broken Hebrew.
Do you think perhaps that's the podcast we do next? The broken Hebrew food with celebrity podcast?
I would pay to do that. I'd pay you
it's
to do
different.
That podcast with me.
I'd listen.
John, let's talk about our favorite celebrity.
Well,
our second favorite celebrity after today's guest, which we'll get
to
in a minute. But I would say in the 1 million years that CSI was on the air, the most amazing guest star celebrity, not our incredible cast, the series regulars, who were all celebrities all amazing, but the best guest star we ever had in terms of kindness, professionalism, amazingness, and radiant light was
Taylor Swift.
That's right.
Yeah.
Taylor Swift.
I look at that picture I have with her.
Yeah.
Often. Not yeah. too often.
No, no.
It's creepy.
Please, no, no. John.
But often.
You're a married man.
Very often.
What was your experience with Taylor Swift?
You know, I was in the makeup. They put makeup on. I had a little wrinkle or two. So I'm in the makeup trailer, and she walks in with her mom. And you're just kind of blown away, like, that's Taylor Swift. I mean, this is a long time ago, and she was a huge star then.
Right.
She's even bigger
right.
now. And somebody else was cool enough to say, can we get a picture?
Okay.
And because I would never do that.
Yeah.
Right? That's frowned upon, I think.
It
right?
is.
Did you
upon.
Ask Wolfgang Puck if you could get a picture with
I
him?
I did indeed.
Yeah.
And I know I'm not supposed to.
But you did. Now you have a picture with Wolfgang Puck.
Well, we had bonded over grapes.
Right. So
it was a brotherhood of the grapes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Continue.
So I'm super glad someone said that, because then I got to take a picture with her, and she was just so kind, so down to earth. Like, you've never met anybody that famous that's that cool.
I agree. I have three Taylor Swift stories. One thing that happened to me, and then two others that I observed.
I love it.
Well, first of all, in the episode, her character was shot
yes.
In the chest. You know, between her breasts, where she was shot.
The chest.
And
illusion.
I on the CSI program played the coroner.
Yeah.
And it was my responsibility to extract the bullet.
Sexy.
I had to be very careful and respectful, as I always am.
Yeah.
So I had to extract this bullet very carefully without touching any, you know, landmarks or anything else around in that area. You know,
she's really on the table. This isn't a body double.
It is her.
It's Taylor
for like
Swift.
Hours. So it was like playing a game of Operation.
Yeah.
You know, we're like, don't touch the sides. You know, and she was so cool and funny and cool and just amazing about it.
And that's a tough place to
yeah.
be. It's hot on that table and it's cold underneath. And she's a trooper.
But I'm like, yeah, indeed. But I'll tell you the two stories which, in my mind, separate her from. Like, I grew up in L.A.
Yeah.
I went to a high school with lots of celebrity kids and
Ooh.
Celebrity adults, you know? But I'll tell you the two stories that kind of separate her from every other celebrity I've ever met.
Yeah.
Just, like, the level of sensitivity, depth, character. So, I don't know if you remember this, but on every day when you come to work, you get a call sheet.
Mm-hmm.
All the actors, everybody who works gets a call sheet. And whenever we'd have a big celebrity, like Taylor Swift or Roger Daltrey, whoever it might be, there'd be a sign that said, no pictures with celebrities. Like, don't bother them.
That's right.
It didn't make a difference who it was. It was like, don't. Faye Dunaway was on the show. It didn't make a difference. But Taylor Swift was such a huge star that I think most of the crew was like willing to like risk being chewed out by a producer just to get a moment of her time. Everybody was bringing their kids. I mean, it was crazy.
Yeah.
So, we had a stand-in, and for those folks at home or in their cars or listening to this podcast, a stand-in might be the least glamorous position on a film or TV set. It's when the director and the cinematographer or the DP are setting up a scene, they get actors who are the same build and height as the stars of the show, as the main actors, and they light the scene around these similar-sized actors. And they're not always treated with a lot of respect,
yeah.
And it's a long day. And we had a stand-in who was on the show for many years named Brian. And Brian was there for many years and a great guy, and maybe didn't always get the same respect that other actors got.
Mm-hmm.
And I witnessed this. Brian walks up to Taylor Swift kind of between takes and kind of sheepishly says, would you mind signing an autograph for my daughter? And Taylor Swift says, oh, well, of course, I'd be happy to. But, you know, I'll be on set tomorrow. Why don't you bring her to set? I'd love to meet her.
Hmm.
Wow. And Brian says, well, I'm divorced, and my daughter lives in Canada with her mother.
Oh.
And Taylor Swift goes, oh, I have a great idea. Mm-hmm. She goes, give me a second. And she runs. She does this. She runs. She finds a piece of paper and a pen, and she says, what's your daughter's name? And I don't remember her name, but for the sake of the story, let's say it was Nicole.
Yeah.
She writes in a big piece of paper, hi, Nicole, your dad is the coolest.
Wow.
Wish you were here with us.
Damn.
You know, love your friend Taylor. Holds it up and says, now let's take a picture send it to her. And it was like, in one foul swoop, her dad was like the, I have chills telling that story because it took so much thought. This little girl who's living with her mother, far away from her father, all of a sudden, her dad is not a stand-in.
Yeah.
He's a famous actor who's friends with Taylor
Swift.
That's
right.
Isn't that amazing?
She changes lives.
Yeah. And then the other one that I thought was really cool, well, there's a few of them, but like And we could talk about Taylor Swift a long time. We're not in a rush. This is our podcast.
It's ours. There's no time limit.
Yeah. So I was talking to her dad, and her dad, who was on set, was really, really nice. And keep in mind, this happened a long time ago, but this is how I remember the story. So if there's any, like, do they call them Swifties? What are they called?
They're Swifties. Yeah, the fans.
That, if I'm getting the story wrong, I apologize. This is the way that I remember it.
Go on.
So Taylor's dad was telling me how much Taylor really loved the show. It was her favorite show. Hmm. And when CSI approached her about being on the show, they told her, okay, it'll be this much money. And she said, okay, I'll pay that.
She'll pay.
Yeah, she thought that she had to pay to be on the show. She thought she had to pay to be in the show. Wow. And they're like, no, we'll pay you, biggest star since the Beatles.
Unbelievable. Yes, that's right. So sweet.
Isn't that amazing?
What if it was like that? You had to pay to be on.
It's kind of getting like that in the show business, isn't
in
it?
In a way. She was ahead of her time.
Yeah. So, yeah. So, and then the other story was in her second to last day, she made an announcement. She said, okay, everybody, if I haven't met your children yet, please bring them to set tomorrow. When I'm through working, I'd love to say hello to every one of them. And the next day, she brought cases of Taylor Swift dolls.
Wow.
And Taylor Swift CDs. And she like set up a desk on one of our sound stages at Universal Studios. And the line wrapped around the soundstage with every crew member. And like, by the way, it wasn't just their kids. It was like their cousins.
Yeah.
And like their cousins' friends.
That's right.
Right? And it was just amazing. And she spent, you know, a good amount of, enough time that everybody felt heard and seen by Taylor Swift. And I just thought, well, that's not just the way that celebrities should act. It's the way, like, we all should act.
We all should act.
Yeah. And then there's Justin Bieber.
Yeah.
And then we'll just leave it at that.
There's spectrums.
Right. There is spectrum. The spectrums of celebrity.
And the way they treat people.
That's right. And it's good to see the yin and the yang.
That's right.
Yeah.
Wow. I am such a Swiftie now because of those stories.
Yeah. But you know what? we mentioned Taylor Swift, who is the second nicest celebrity that I've ever met. Because the nicest celebrity that I've ever met.
Yeah.
John.
Henry Winkler.
Henry Winkler is an amazing.
He's really nice.
He is so nice, Henry Winkler. He is such a great celebrity. And you said Mark Harmon.
Mark Harmon was super nice to me.
Could you tell the Mark Harmon story?
I mean, sure, David. I was on the show NCIS.
Yes.
And Mark Harmon was on that show. And I just was a guest star. He doesn't know who I am, but I'm sitting there in the chair that you wait to go on scene. And he says to me, hey, I'm Mark Harmon.
Yeah.
Can I get you some water?
What?
And I said,
it wasn't Mark Harmon. It wasn't a stand-in?
No, it was straight up Mark Harmon. Uh-huh. Can I get you some water? And I said, no, you're Mark Harmon. Can I get you some water?
Wow.
Yeah.
And then what happened?
Then he laughed a little bit. And then we both just got waters from the prop person.
That's a fantastic story.
It's not that good.
No, it is good. But I will tell you, today's guest is not just the nicest celebrity I've ever met. He might be the nicest person I've ever met. I would, our audience at home, think of the nicest person that you've ever met. Could be a teacher, could be an uncle, grandparent. Today's guest is 10 to 15% nicer than whoever you're thinking of.
Well said.
Today's guest is, John, you do the honors.
I mean, they saw it when they clicked on it, but it's Ted Danson.
It's why we're all here.
It's why we came up with this podcast secretly, so we could have a chance to speak to Ted Danson.
In our seventh episode.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you got to build up the crowd, you know?
And yeah.
So, Ted, if you think about it, You think about him every day, right? He's on your TV in a commercial, or you're going past your channels, you see a Becker episode, you see a Cheers episode, there's Mr. Mayor, there's whatever he's on.
Yeah.
He's been on our TV forever.
And he has graciously agreed to be in the podcast today to talk about his time on CSI.
I love it. I'm so thrilled that we have him. He's a generous man. We have great stories with Ted.
So without further ado, Mr. Ted Danson.
Our guest today is an actor, producer, environmental rights activist, and let's be honest, an American legend. His credits include Cheers, CSI Crime Scene Investigation, The Good Place, and an endless list of iconic TV shows and movies. Ladies and gentlemen, Ted Danson.
Hi.
Hello.
Oh my gosh. I'm speechless. We can't thank you enough for doing this. And we're just so, so happy to see you, Ted.
I can't tell you how many times I've thought about you guys, literally.
Holy shit, are we recording this?
Yeah, you are.
CSI gave John and I so many gifts. It really did. But one of its great gifts was getting to know you. So it's such a thrill to see you again. Thank you.
I feel the same way about you, truthfully. And you, John. Wow. David and I, we'll get to it later, had an experience that was one of those life-altering experiences that we shared together, or at least it was for me. And so you are forever in my thoughts.
One thing that we are going to talk to our criminalists about is kind of separating what they do for a living and their home life. Like, how do you spend the day really submerged in the darkest aspects of humanity and then go home and tuck your kids in at night and, you know, have a nice time with your wife? Did you ever take CSI home with you? Was it difficult to kind of leave, or do you just see it as a job like anything else?
I guess sometimes. As an actor, you're usually focused hard on hitting your marks and being real and getting the words right. So the process of acting is what you take home the most. There'd be some days where the most believable and hard part of doing CSI was not standing over an actor who was trying not to sneeze or something, pretending to be dead. It was when you were over bodies that had been burned. Mm-hmm. And our special effects department, which was astounding,
right,
you know, had created these bodies. That was hard. Sometimes the visual, even though we're in make-believe land, the visual stuck in your eyes sometimes longer than I would have liked. One of the big things I took away was the courage. They serve society by going into places no one else wants to go to.
Oh, yeah.
You don't want to think about death. And you certainly don't want to look at death. And you certainly don't want to figure out who the really bad person was that did this horrible thing to another human being. And here you have people who aren't, you know, they're not just wounded, crazy people who love gore and death. They're, you know, Bob and Mary around the corner who have kids and a life. And yet they run into the fire. They run towards the dark side of life. I have so much respect for that because that's not me. And yet we need that. The world, life, society needs that kind of, you know, sacrifice that people make to do this job.
Did you feel any kind of additional responsibility to kind of represent these people? Yeah, me too.
I'm blanking on his Larry Mitchell.
Larry Mitchell.
Yeah. Right. Because we had two or three, you guys over the years probably had dozens of real CSI retired consultants, usually.
And Larry Mitchell had worked with the LA County Sheriff's Department and was our on-set technical advisor. Yep.
Right. Played Officer Mitchell.
Yeah,
he did.
On occasion. Mm-hmm. When he introduced himself, I said, how do you do this? How do you... I go through life with my rose-colored glasses on, just saying, wow, isn't this wonderful? I love life. How do you do that? How do you keep your spirit up after seeing what you describe as way too much cruelty, way too much human cruelty to other humans? How do you keep your spirits up? And it was that, the realization of the fragility of life and to cherish every moment and to go home to your family, your kids, and don't take anything for granted was what he said. And it, so basically it was that gratitude. Be grateful for the fact that you're breathing. Not everybody gets to.
Yeah, that's beautifully said. So you alluded to a moment ago, you and I going to Las Vegas. Before we get into that, I'm just so curious. When people think Ted Danson, they don't, I think, automatically think gritty drama, crime scene investigator, police procedural.
It was an amazing thing to step into such a juggernaut with such amazing actors who'd been working and the writers who'd been working for so long, you know, at the top of their game. It was really cool.
Were you nervous about doing something so different?
Yes. And I remember sitting with you on the plane.
Yeah.
Full of self-doubt because David was going to escort me to Las Vegas and show me around the town and the coroner's office and meet with, I can't remember the gentleman's name who was one of the inspirations for the show.
What
was
Dr. Gary Telgenoff, the chief medical officer in Clark County.
Was he the one that had all these kind of wonderfully horrific but funny stories about autopsies?
That's exactly him. He also was a punk rocker, and he had a punk group called Skinner Rat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That trip, man, I can still start to vibrate and feel the adrenaline rush just thinking about, I remember sitting on the plane with you and you said, well, how do you feel? And I'm going, I am terrified. I have no idea if I can do this. This is not in my wheelhouse. You know, I make jokes. I make jokes about whatever, but I don't do crime dramas. You know, I'm the last person you would believe if you stuck a gun in my hand, it'd be like, no, take the gun away. It doesn't work. I don't believe it. So you were, I think, sweet, but kind of thought I was, I don't know what, bit of an idiot.
Well, I remember what I said to you. Sorry to cut you off. I just couldn't believe it. You said, do you think I could do it? And I said, you're Ted Danson.
That's right.
And you said, I am Ted Danson. Thanks. And it was true because it was like, of course you could do it. You were incredible. Another interview that you gave recently, Ted, that what scares you most is kind of alpha male energy.
Yeah.
And I think why you were so great in that role is that you took a role that I think law enforcement and men in particular are associated with a degree of John Wayne alpha male energy. You brought a certain sensitivity, I think, to DB that had been missing from shows like that.
A touch of Doris Day.
Just a touch.
That's right.
Just a skosh.
Will you talk about that day? So you land in Vegas. The two of you have never met each other, and now you're off to an autopsy?
So when we got to Vegas, we checked in the hotel, and I think you disappeared for a while and said, I'm just going to go through this door here. You go through that door, and that take you to your rooms. And I'm just going to go gamble for a little while. And I was like,
that's not right.
And you know, I was like, oh, no, don't leave me. But okay, off we go to the coroner's office. Is that right?
At 6 a.m. the next morning.
Oh, it was the next morning. Yeah, you're right.
I remember we had a really nice dinner. Our waitress called you Tony Danza, thought you were Tony Danza.
Yes. Which, by the way, there was a long period of time, little sidebar.
Yeah.
The first time it happened, I was in New York and these construction workers went, hey, Tony.
What?
And I kept walking and they went, hey, Tony. And I just kept walking, you know. And then they went, oh, I see, Tony. You're too good for us now. So, yeah. Well, I don't know if he got confused, but I guess the TD in my, you know, Tony Danza, Ted Danza.
You didn't correct the waitress, which I thought was nice. You didn't embarrass her. You just thanked her for the compliment and, you know, your wonderful work on Taxi and moved on. That's great.
Angela. Mona.
Anyway, yeah, we had a lovely dinner. And we met and had a very civilized conversation with the chief coroner. And then he sent us off with somebody else. And I remember walking down a hallway and seeing all these black, shiny body bags on gurneys, I guess, of people who within the last 24 hours had passed away or killed or died or somehow. And it started to get really real.
Yeah.
And then I passed one bag and they had, I guess sometimes they'd leave the toe out, which had a tag around the toe that had the name of the person. And to see a dead toe sticking out of the body bag was, you know, really started to get my heart pumping. Then we go around the corner and they suit us up with, you know, our masks and our gloves and everything. And I can kind of see through the glass in the door that there is a quadruple autopsy going on. They had four bodies there.
Yeah.
And the door opens. You usually hide behind this. I'm an actor. It's Hollywood. Nothing can go wrong. You know, we're renowned for not putting on seatbelts because it's Hollywood. Nothing can go wrong. So I walk through the door thinking, this is Hollywood. It'll be okay, Ted. It'll be a great experience. And then the smell, very specific. Refrigerated, very cold. Maybe the meat in the refrigerator went a little bad, maybe a day or two older than it should be, filled my nose, and my heart started to pump. And there were four bodies. The first one was completely the Y cut. Is that what it's called?
The Y incision,
And, you know, ribs out. It was like, that to me was like a science experiment. My heart was pumping. It was extraordinary to see. And then someone else had opened the gut and they were weighing all the different organs or the intestines or whatever. That got even a little freakier. But the scariest was the fourth person who was lying there everyone was nude, obviously, lying there like he had just gone to sleep. They hadn't started working on him.
He had gotten a foot massage.
Yes.
Died of a brain hemorrhage several hours later while getting a foot massage.
And it was not a Vegas euphemism. He literally was getting a foot massage and then started snoring really loudly and died.
The death rattle. That's, I remember that's what they called it. Yeah.
Yeah. And then you and I, they brought us over to the first gentleman, and I think I held the skull cap while you ground something.
Well, I remember we were standing there, and I was not expecting to participate, and the medical examiner took the bone saw, and he sawed off the skull cap, and he, you know, pulled it off, and then he said, Ted, hold this. And I look at you, and you're holding this skull cap.
They want you to scrape the brain out.
He hands me like what looks like a pair of pliers.
Yeah.
And he has me pull out the ligament which attaches the brain to the spinal cord. And it was hard. I remember doing it. And I actually, just as a brief aside, I had only been in America for about 48 hours. I had spent the previous 3 months in Israel shooting a documentary about the Bible for National Geographic and still hadn't slept very much. It all felt like a dream. And I remember thinking 48 hours earlier, I'd been telling Bible stories in the Judean desert, and now I'm performing an autopsy with Sam Malone because I didn't know you that well, right? And just thinking, this is a story. Most dreams I've had aren't that weird.
Yeah. And then we got through that. And then I remember going back to the hotel and you walked down a hallway and said, I'm going to slip in here and gamble before our lunch or dinner or something. And I'm just quivering. And I say, fine. And I go upstairs, call my wife, Mary, and start to tell her the experience and burst into tears.
Really?
You're gambling. I'm upstairs crying. It was such a huge
experience.
We
all cope in our different ways, Ted.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember looking at myself in the mirror, looking at my body and going, thank you. I don't know how you're doing it, but oh Lord, thank you so much. The fragility of life was so viscerally clear, which is why I wanted to do that, which is why I wanted that experience. It's one thing to go on a show and learn your lines and be full of gravitas standing over a pretend dead body, but to have experienced that and the fragility of life was an amazing experience.
And did you do more to help with the research of CSI? Did you go on a ride-along or do any of the crime scene?
No, I didn't. I think pretty much jumped right into the show.
We went to the hospital. Do you remember that, Ted? We went to the crime lab and we did a little ride-along. And whoever we were with took us to the hospital. And what I remember the most is walking through the hospital and somebody was in bed and said, yo, Dr. Becker. Remember that? That's what I remember about that day. And you remember you told me people under the age of 40 will call you Dr. Becker. And if it's over the age of 40, it was cheers.
Yeah.
And I remember just how well you handled that. But that's what stuck with me. I don't know if you remember that at all.
I think we met the person at the scene, then went back to the hospital with them.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, I do remember that.
John had said earlier when we were talking that when he saw his first autopsy, it kind of challenged his notions of God and spirituality. Was there something about seeing a dead body that did something similar for you?
Yeah, I mean, it just, I guess, emphasized the mystery of life. You know, you think you're in control. We always create our own little reality where we're in control. Or if somebody dies, they go, how did they die? Oh, right. Okay, I see what they did wrong. I won't do that. You know, you're always spinning it to be in control. And I think that was one of those moments. It's so viscerally real that you are not in control.
And is that what made you weepy with Mary? That you were saying, I realize how out of control?
It's also awesome. It wasn't just fear, because my reaction was also to look at my body in the mirror and go, I don't know how you're doing this. Your heart's been pumping, you're this, that, all those things that I saw people scraping a brain out. Everything about it was the wonder of the body. It wasn't just the fragility, but it was also the wonder of the human body. Kind of was awesome. It kind of reminded me, to be honest, as being there for my daughter's birth. Death is as awesome as birth. minus the cheery hopefulness of, you know, birth.
Sure.
I was struck. I remember my first autopsy. It was a gentleman around my age, maybe a couple years older, who had died in a car accident. But just through the particulars of the injury, he had no marks on him at all. He had just broken his neck and died. And he just looked like he was asleep. This morning, he woke up. He had the next 40 years ahead of him. And now he is on this table. It just was another reminder for me to appreciate every single moment, every bite of food, every ray of sunshine.
Gratitude. To me, everything comes down. And at my age, I'm 73. Gratitude. I'm just grateful. You can't say, oh, you deserve it, or, oh, this is why you're here, or this is why you have blessings. All you can do is say, thank you.
Yeah, you know? Thank you.
Thank you. Mm. This life that I've been given, I was given. Thank you.
I forgot the name of the philosopher, but he said, the only word we ever said was thank you. That would be enough. I think that's true.
Mm. I do too.
To pull it back for a moment, back to CSI. So you did CSI for 4 years?
4 years and then CSI Cyber, yeah.
You enjoy it?
Here's what I enjoyed, because it was, to be real, it was the hardest job I'd ever had, acting-wise. All of you, truly, I love being around. First off, I'm a Pollyanna. I love going to work. I've never gone to work and not been thrilled. I always enjoy work. But I really enjoyed the actors and the writers of the show and the camaraderie and the juggernautness of the show. That was all really interesting. By the time I got there, the ratings in the U.S. were so-so. Mm-hmm. But around the world, the show was still the number one watched show in the world. And to go to Cannes for the Film TV Festival or something and to experience being part of a number one show in the world was really amazing. And I'm totally grateful for it.
We had one day at work and it was a particularly long day with lots of, you know, fog machines, and it was hot. You know, it was a long day at work, and we had been there about, you know, 10, 11 hours. And I just said, Ted, how you doing? And you go, it's like being at the spa. And I thought, how could anybody complain when number one in the call sheet is so joyful to be there? It just set a really great example. John, did you have similar experiences you've told me about?
Ted, I mean, I've heard Meryl Streep described this way, but that you treat the work so seriously, but you're having so much fun at the same time. And I think that's what I found so invigorating working with you. I remember I'd be sitting there like delivering lines, but in my head I'm going, it's Ted Danson I'm talking to. Like, don't mess up. You'd be wasting his time. And it was great. It was just so much fun every day. I'd be pinching myself. I think there was this sense too of, it's going to be over someday. Like, I couldn't enjoy it because I knew it wouldn't last. Like, I couldn't just live in the moment going, oh, this is so amazing. I would go, well, years from now, I won't be working with Ted Danson anymore.
Well, we have to fix that.
Yes.
Agreed.
It was also the hardest job that I've ever done, acting-wise, because we weren't doing Waiting for Lefty or David Mamet or something, you know, where it's like, hey, honey, you know, screw me, screw you. You know, it was all very technical. And because the idea of the show is to make the audience or allow the audience to play along and try to figure out who was responsible for this, who was guilty, it was like a soap opera. You were saying the same things over and over again. It was not like I was talking to another character, David, you know, or John. I was talking to the audience, pretending to be talking to you. And our job was to, as actors, was to try to make that real. But by and large, that was, for me, a heavy lift. That was hard. Rewarding. Audience loved it. But it was, do you know what I'm talking about?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, we do. I mean, I probably said, if this is a kind of a close cousin of what you're saying, I think I must have said, TOD's around midnight, lividity is fixed, ligature marks around the neck and wrist, probably 500 times. You know, I'm not saying that to anybody in particular, but it's key information. There's a version of that has to be delivered to the audience.
I remember Merritt once telling me, will you stop saying blood spatter? Just stop it. I don't want to hear blood spatter ever again.
In terms of just the nitty gritty of acting on something that was a departure for you, in terms of preparing yourself, just, I remember for me, what was really difficult was learning that medical lingo. I remember once I had just about a paragraph, just a straight medical lingo. And I had a buddy of mine come over and I just read it over and over again, just so it would sink in, because it doesn't come naturally. What was your experience preparing for that role day in and day out?
I think what you said is true, that repetition and making sure you literally understand what it is you're saying. Because if you don't, then you get lost, the audience gets lost and bored, yeah. You know. So saying it enough, learning what it is you're talking about enough so that you can live genuinely in that moment, to me, is almost the full plate. I've ridden around with cops before. The Onion Field, first film I did, I got to ride around for a week with a Hollywood Division policeman. And you do learn a lot. It does impact you.
It's interesting you were saying that you didn't think maybe you'd be able to pull it off. And I've heard you speak about Cheers, that maybe it took a year and a half for you to get comfortable with being a womanizer because that wasn't you. So I wonder if you step into a lot of roles thinking, how do I pull this off? And then does the research, like I know you went to bartending school for Cheers, now you went to the medical examiner for CSI, does that help you kind of feel, oh, maybe I can pull this off? Or what does that do?
It relieves the doubt.
Mm-hmm.
Because what you don't want to do is, okay, now I'm going to pretend to be such and such. If you go see people do it, you go, oh, they're not any different than I am. Their body of knowledge is. Yes, absolutely. You're fine, Ted, to be the head of a CSI unit. You look, you sound, you could be it. I think you try to remove all of the things that you don't believe you're capable of doing to get rid of that thought. So that you go, I don't have to act. I'm good enough as I am, is kind of a job. I think that's what you do with research. That's what you do with rehearsing. All of that is what makes you comfortable to say I'm good enough.
That's awesome.
Well, you're certainly good enough. And we are so grateful that you took some time to talk to us today, Ted. It really is just such wonderful seeing you and hearing you again.
Back at you. Really, really fun to see your sweet faces.
Na 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 na.
I mean,
come on.
Why does it have to end?
I know.
Can we just talk to him every day?
Do you remember like a few years ago?
Yeah.
I guess more like 10 years ago.
Okay.
We went to Ted Danson's house.
Yes.
And
who could forget?
And I in my mind, the rest of my life is about getting back to that space of being at his house.
That was the highlight.
Yeah, like Ted's house is not a place, it's a state of mind, you know? And I feel like now I could just listen to this podcast whenever I want to be put into that state of mind.
Your happy place.
Yeah. Guys, friends, if you enjoyed today's podcast, John, tell them what to do.
Oh, you can go to patreon.com. You can search our show, which is CS I Love You, the podcast. And there's different subscriber levels, and you can get all sorts of goodies. Nothing as nice as a stay at Ted Danson's house. But well, there's other things
we'll
that are
Ted.
Close.
Ted's so nice, he might offer
he
that.
He might offer that, yeah. The highest level there.
Yeah.
And so check that out. And if you enjoyed our show, you can go ahead and check out our Instagram. You can leave us a message. Just go to CS I Love You, the podcast.
We love to hear from all of you. Our fans, they're not really our fans. They're our friends.
I mean that.
I've had a chance to interact with many of our listeners on Instagram. I'm always happy to respond if there's a question, a concern.
Same here.
A criticism.
Anything.
Yeah.
Just reach out, folks.
And, you know, this show couldn't happen without the following amazing people.
Name them.
Our producer and engineer and maestro. I think he's a maestro.
Uh-huh.
Jordan Katz, the great Jordan Katz. Dan Byrne, who wrote our fabulous theme song.
Indeed.
Do you ever hum that theme song?
All night long. I can't even sleep. It's in my head.
It's so good. There's been many different versions of the show. It was going to be a TV show one time. It had several other names. Dan has written a theme song for every single one of the different versions of CSI.
It's true. You can release an LP.
Yeah. It had different names. Yeah. And we should do that. Maybe one episode. Maybe when it's a little light on content.
Sure, sure.
We should just play all the versions.
Yeah.
Right. But I digress. We have to talk about two fabulous people.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Shane, yes. Who helps with everything.
Social
and
media.
Emily, who helps with everything.
Yeah. So. They're just amazing utility men and women.
And to you, the listeners, thanks for listening. Do it again.
Until next crime.
Vermin Weller and their crew, CSI.